So we'll pick up our discussion where we left off yesterday, where we ended 2 days of discussion on how it is that for Deaconic, Aquinas specifies exactly what a common good is and what the common goods are. The goods are what all things desire, and so much that we desire their perfection. They bear the note of final cause, goods, first of causes, and they're diffusive of themselves. And then we saw yesterday specifically how, for Aquinas, the question of the reality of the diffusion of the good and the fact that goods diffuse themselves variously. Some extend their goodness to many effects, many beings, others to fewer effects, fewer beings, still others to one effect or one being. This is the principle according to which goods self-order, create a kind of hierarchy. Those goods at the lower end of the hierarchy are those that diffuse themselves the least. Those at the highest, higher end of the hierarchy, are those that extend themselves the most. And because they extend themselves the most, they're the more communicative, they're the most extensive, they're also the most attractive, and therefore demand a kind of, or demand a love that's commensurate to their excellence, to their nobility. And then we specified really what for Aquinas the common good, properly speaking, is, that they're goods of order, of which the human person constitutes a material part. And so what he has in mind specifically is, as common goods, is the good of the family, the good of the city, the good of the universe. These occur naturally. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit more about tomorrow, God being the common good of all things, insofar as he's the first cause and final end of all good. It's interesting to note that for Aquinas, common good properly speaking, common goods properly speaking, are rather few in number. There aren't many of them, properly speaking. Goods common in causando. Again, they're these wholes of order of which persons constitute parts. And it's the good of the persons insofar as the good of the whole is the good of the part. And that parts act for the good of their whole. They're naturally inclined to the good of the whole. And therefore have a natural love for the good of the whole. The good of the family, the good of the city, the good of the universe, and finally, God. So picking up where we left off then yesterday, we now have to look at the question of how it is really then that the common good is a good of the human person. So now that we've identified what the common goods are, we will explore a little more closely how it is that the common good, these goods of order, are proper goods of the human creature. How the human creature relates then to the common good. And that means we'll be examining today what, for Aquinas, is the bonum sum. Which is a short Latin phrase which, for Aquinas, kind of works as a technical term for what we can translate as the proper good. It means his good or its good. The good that it's proper to a particular thing. And when examining what Aquinas has to say about the bonum sum, the proper good, Aquinas makes several fundamental points, and let's review those quickly because he makes some important distinctions here. First, he says that any good that contributes to the perfection of a thing is for that reason proper to the thing. In view of what is required to perfect a thing's nature, a good that perfects a thing's nature, that contributes to the perfection of a thing's nature, is for that reason proper, a proper good for that thing. For example, sunlight and water are proper goods of plants, Hay is a proper good for horses. Truth and friendship are proper goods of man. The point that Aquinas, that Descartes really wants to emphasize here, and this is important for his polemic with the personalists, is that proper good is not synonymous with particular good. And this is a problem because in everyday speech we can all do this. That we can use the term proper good connoting simply the particular good. Descartes points out that for Aquinas, proper good, the bonum sum, is a genus of good. And the particular good is just one species within that genus. A thing's proper good includes particular goods, but not exclusively. A thing's proper good also includes whatever common goods the thing's nature requires for perfection. Is relatively simple. It's just to say that among the goods that perfect a given nature, among the goods that are proper to the perfection of that nature, we find both goods particular and goods that are common, goods that extend their goodness to that nature individually, or goods that extend their goodness to that individual, but also to many other individuals at once. So among the goods that perfect a given nature, we find both particular and common goods. So the proper good then isn't simply a synonym for the particular good, but should be understood to include all of the goods that perfect a given nature, be that particular or common. Deconic writes in his essay, and I reproduce this on page 187 in the dissertation, "The good is that which all things desire inasmuch as they desire their perfection. This perfection is for each thing its good, bonum suum. And in this sense, its good is a proper good. But then the proper good is not opposed to the common good. In fact, the proper good to which a thing naturally tends, the bonum suum, can be understood in different ways according to the diverse goods in which a thing finds its perfection." We created beings find our perfection, Aquinas says, in many things, in many goods. There's not just one good out there, you know, that's proper to us. We need lots of things. We're needy beings. We need food and water. We need shelter and clothing. We need a proper climate. Proper terrain, other people, language, lots of things that are proper to us, lots of goods that are proper to us. Family, city, and ultimately God. Among these goods, some are particular. You know, we enjoy them, they just are for us and us alone, and others are commonly shared with others. So to help us understand then the diverse goods, the many goods that constitute one's proper good, Descartes points to an important passage from Aquinas' Summa Contra Gentiles, and that's the first passage that I have on the handout that you were given this morning.
I'm sorry,
okay. Oh, sure. Does everybody have one, I should ask? Yeah. Handout only has the appearance of being popular. It's quite particular.
Okay. What Aquinas explains in this text is that
goods become proper to individual natures, and let's just say he's dealing here with sensate creatures, so animals and above, so the brutes and everything above, that goods become proper to them according to different formalities, different ways of considering their being and identity. And we'll look at each of these four after we read through this passage, just by way of introduction, and we'll look at each of these four formalities more closely. Aquinas writes, "Now, the proper good of anything can be grasped in several ways. In one way, certainly, we consider what is proper to a thing as an individual, ratione individui. Thus, an animal desires its good when it desires food, by which the animal is conserved in being. Second, we consider what is proper to a thing as a member of a species, ratione speciei. Thus, an animal desires its proper good when it desires to generate and nourish offspring, or when it desires to perform any other action aimed at the conservation and defense of the individuals of its species. Third, we consider what is proper to a thing as a member of a genus, ratione generis. It is thus that an equivocal agent, desires its proper good by causing, as do the heavens." That's about as clear as mud right there. So we'll talk about that in a second, because De Coninck, in his commentary on this, is going to, you know, adjust it a bit, make it a bit clearer. Fourth, we consider what is proper to a thing as it bears an analogical likeness to its sorts. Ratione similitudinis analogiae principiatorum ad suum principium. Thus God, who is beyond genus, gives being to all things according to his goodness. So you see what Aquinas is doing here. He's kind of marching up kind of the way in which we classify things, you know, individual, species, genus. What he notices is that as we consider individuals according to just their individuality, according to the species they belong to, according to the genus that belong to, according to those formalities, various goods begin to appear as proper to that individual, to that member of that species, to the member of that genus. And then finally, the fourth category really touches on every creature, I mean, every created thing. Participates analogously, has some analogous similitude to its cause. And insofar as it exists, it possesses the act of being, it participates in God's being in analogous similitude. And because of that, God is then, you know, the end, the final end of every creature. So let's look closely then at each of these four formalities and see what's important to note about each. So first, the proper good. The individual. The proper good of a thing insofar as it's just an individual thing. The proper good of a thing insofar as it is an individual. Goods that provide, goods that are proper at this level and under this formality are goods that provide for the individual's basic survival. They're enjoyed by the individual qua individual. And what characterizes the proper goods in this category is the note of particularity. Under this formality, the individual enjoys his individual goods. Goods that extend their goodness solely to one beneficiary. These are goods that are proper to the self qua individual, and thus are enjoyed by the self alone. Again, my banana is my banana, my potato is my potato, my shirt is my shirt. You know, there's only one of us that can wear it, you know, at a time. There's only one of us that can eat it, you know, at a time. It's not, that's just not some kind of accident of matter, but it's how that particular good is constituted as a good, how it extends its goodness in a very limited way, only to one. So the proper good
creazione speciale as a member of a species.
The next one.
The proper good of a thing insofar as it is a member of a species, these goods include generation and nutrition of offspring and defense of the members of the species, other members of the species. Those are the examples just given by Aquinas himself. And as we can see already, in moving from the good ratione individui to the good ratione specie, we've made a quantum leap forward in the quality of the good. If in pursuing his proper good ratione individui, a person strives for his own survival, in pursuing the proper good ratione specie, the person strives for the survival of others. First, in bringing others into existence and nourishing them to maturity through generation, and in defending others from danger. What's key here is that the existence of others and the survival and defense of others becomes a proper good of the individual. And we can say more about this, but the whole virtue of justice is predicated on this reality. Read Aquinas on Justice, the entire treatise. There's no concern for the individual, really, and kind of claims for his own rights. The perfection of the virtue, which sits in the will of the individual, is turned outward to the other to make sure that what he legitimately claims, he gains. It's providing the other his due and not securing my own due. So at the level of the species good, others enter the picture, bringing others into existence and preserving them from danger.
Sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
Just to clarify, mm-hmm. Does that include, if it's the individual good of another member of your species, and you do something to help them get an individual good,
In part, but it's not just, you don't just work for, the more, I would say for Aquinas, the more perfect pursuit of the one's proper good, ratione specie, is that, as we'll see in a second, it's securing the higher common goods that are proper to the members of the species, and not just their particular good. Although that's going to be taken up into that. Which is how, in a sense, the church kind of talks about the common good, which in some ways is illuminating, in some ways not. I mean, the common good is the sum total of conditions necessary for the flourishing of an individual and social life. So what's good about that is that it has this sense is that it's not just a question of securing particular goods, but you've got this sense that it's something more than that. It's that it's creating the climate for social goods to flourish. In which people pursue their particular goods. So in the pursuit of one's proper good, ratione specie, in pursuit of one's species good, the human individual strives for a good greater than his particular good. Greater than his individual good, he strives for the good of his species. Qua member of a species, the individual enjoys the good of his species as his proper good, over and above the proper good of his individual survival. That's what's kind of amazing about the act of generation, right? There's little to no kind of individual benefit to that, to bringing another human being into existence. The benefit is all enjoyed by the new person who all of a sudden exists. And yet that's a greater good for the generator than just working for his mere survival. And that's Aquinas' view, and that's what he's getting at here. The survival of others who share in the same species good is the individual's proper good. And so Deconinck points out this is latent in Aquinas' teaching, that it's at this level of his species good, of man's species good, that the good of the family and the good of the city emerge as proper goods for man. And that's why this is really important for the kind of essay here. And when he goes through these four, he spends a whole lot of time at this level. But it's here that the family and the city emerge as proper goods for the human creature. Human individuals integrate socially to achieve and secure as a member of a species, not simply qua individual, but qua member of a species, the good of the species. And Aquinas makes this point not in the Summa Contra Gentiles, but in his commentary on the Ethics. That's the second text I have for you there. In commenting on book one of the Ethics in his very first lecture, Aquinas says this: because man requires for life many things, he cannot acquire alone. Because man requires for life many things he cannot acquire alone, he is naturally a social animal and constitutes a part of some multitude through which he receives help to live well. This help is twofold. First, a man needs help to acquire the things necessary to sustain life, things without which life cannot continue. To acquire these necessities, a man receives help from the domestic community of which he is a part, the family. For instance, every individual receives life, nutrition, education, and similar things from his parents. What is more, the members of the domestic community assist each other to acquire the basics of life. This is a little more explicit statement of what I mentioned yesterday, that for Aquinas' view, I mean, his view of the family is kind of fascinating, because, yeah, you have this kind of common good, this domestic society whose life is organized around the acquiring and enjoyment of particular goods. I mean, those that are, as Aquinas says here, those that are necessary for survival, simply to live. But second, a man is helped by the multitude of which he is a part in order to acquire a perfect sufficiency of life, namely, that he might not only live, but live well, having at hand everything that provides for a good life. Thus, the individual receives the help of the civic community, the political community, of which he is a part, not only to support his bodily needs, as there are many handicrafts a city can provide that a single household cannot, but also his moral needs, spiritual needs. As the public authority, through the fear of punishment, holds insolent youth in check regarding the things which paternal admonition remains powerless to correct. That's Aquinas' kind of get off my lawn. You're just roving bands of, you know, wild adolescents running around, not listening to their parents. But thank God we have the police. And that contributes to our good living socially. It is a curious example. You think that he's kind of moving in another direction, but no, it's no. Who knows what was happening around the priory in Paris at the time? So, kind of meaning on this myself, I try to summarize this page 191 in the dissertation. I write this: while Aquinas grants that the person does benefit individually from membership in a family and in the political community, that is part of the benefit of being in the family and political community, that these communities do provide for us individual particular goods. He argues that it's not qua individual that the person enjoys these benefits. Rather, it is qua member of a species. Consequently, the family and the city exist not for the individual qua individual, but for many individuals qua members of a species. Within these communities, the individual pursues activities aimed not at his own survival, which may result all the same. We tend to survive in our families. We tend to survive, you know, in the city. And that's a good thing. But our life in these communities is aimed not at our own individual survival, or only, but at the survival of many individuals together, and of the species as a whole. Thus, the communities of the family and the city themselves, as the ends to which the members of a species act commonly, constitute true goods, bona honesta, desired for their own sake, as incarnating the good of the species itself. The family and the city, therefore, do not represent goods instrumental to the individual, but rather groupings, wholes of order, natural to the species, in which members of the species together pursue commonly the goods of the species. Accordingly, families and cities aim not at preserving the particular existence of the individual, but at providing a home for the common life natural to social animals. And so as the individual's proper good ratione specie is better, nobler, more extensive than his proper good ratione individui, de Koenig says that the human individual naturally prefers his species good to his individual good. That by nature, he's inclined to prefer this good. De Koenig, following Aquinas, finds this preference inscribed in nature. Everywhere, individuals sacrifice their particular good for the species good. Parts sacrifice themselves for the whole. Individuals put their individual good at risk for the good of their families and the good of their political community. In his essay, when he really gets to this point and establishes the family and the city as proper goods of the human individual ratione specie, not just ratione individui, that's really all he needs to combat his personalist opponents. And he does so with just that. But De Koenig continues because he realizes that there's more to say about the proper good here. That even the enjoyment of our species goods finds itself or falls within a greater context, but there are even greater goods than these, greater goods than the family and the city, to which we're oriented, which are proper to us. And why and how? That's what we'll look at now. The proper good, ratione generis. As the member, as a member of the genus of a genus of intellectual creatures, maybe that's good to specify.
What are we talking about here? So here's just the mere individual. Here we're talking about the, let's say, the rational animal. And here we're talking about an intellectual.
So within the genus of intellectual creatures, we are rational animals, but there are also other members of this genus, the angels. But as the member of a genus of intellectual creatures, man is able to apprehend, comprehend, and thus love good, goods that lie beyond the good of his species. Qua intelligent being, man can surpass the limits of his species in a way, and in a way, as Aquinas says, man can become all things. Aquinas writes in the third book of his commentary on Aristotle's De Anima, the soul becomes, in some way, all things through its being receptive of all forms. It's receptive of all forms because of its intellectual nature. Page 201, I write this just briefly in summary. Receptivity to the whole of created being, and thus to the whole of created goodness, is proper to individuals who belong to a genus of intellectual beings. Because we have intelligence, spiritual intelligence, not just sense intelligence. Our knowledge, our reasoning, extends beyond simply sensible singulars. To grasp the forms and comprehend the forms of things, and not just the things individually in themselves, but also the order of things among themselves. whatever of being the intelligent agent is able to grasp intelligently, whether higher or lower than his own being, is his proper good, ratione genus. And for de Koninck, then, it's here that the common good of the universe becomes a proper good of man, insofar as he's a member of an intellectual genus. Again, on page 201, it is not only the forms of all things individually that human intelligence may grasp, but also their ordering one to another. And not only their ordering one to another, but also their ordering according to the whole. Man's knowledge of the order of things, up to and including the ordering of the universe, constitutes the proper good ratione generis that de Koninck highlights. As de Koninck climbs the hierarchy of the bonum suum, he identifies in man's proper good ratione generis another common good in causando. To the common goods of the family and the city, he adds the common good of the universe. We'll have more to say about the common good of the universe in tomorrow's discussion. And lastly, the proper good, ratione similitudinis analogiae principiatorum et suum principium, we'll just shorten that to similitudinis analogiae. Despite the intimidating name, the concept here is rather straightforward. Insofar as all created things participate in the being of the Creator, God emerges here as a proper good of every created thing. Insofar as every effect bears some likeness and similitude to its cause, every created thing, therefore, bears some likeness and similitude to the Creator. Because all creatures are begotten of God, they are effects of His creative power. All creatures thus bear an analogous similitude to God. They possess God's unbegotten perfections variously in a begotten mode. This is on page 202, I'm sorry. Consequently, analogous effects incline naturally to their causes. All creatures incline naturally to God, the first cause, as their highest and proper good and end. God is for all created things, therefore, their proper good, ratione similitudinis analogiae. As proper to all creatures, God is their highest common good. And it's thus for Aquinas that all creatures naturally love God more than they love themselves. It's a very curious thing for Aquinas to say. He said not to have any experience of this. And yet he insists on the point as a metaphysical truth. All creatures naturally love God more than they love themselves. I summarize the point here on 202 to 203. God's goodness is not the final end of creatures by extrinsic imposition, as if creatures were ontologically indifferent to God's goodness and succumb only to its attractive force, finding it irresistible. On the contrary, Aquinas explains that creatures are ordered intrinsically to God because He is their first agent, their origin and first cause. Accordingly, creatures bear an analogous similarity to God. And it is this similarity of being and goodness that orders and inclines creatures back to God. As the imperfect effect inclines to its perfect cause, all creatures strive naturally, quoting Aquinas, to become like God. And if you're looking for a text from Aquinas himself on this, I reproduce it there. It's the third one on your sheet. In the Summa Theology, the Prima Pars, question 60. Since God himself is the universal good, and under this good are included angels and men and all creatures, because insofar as any creature exists, it is naturally of God, it follows that by a natural love, angels and men love God more than themselves and before themselves. Or else if an angel or man loved himself more than God, it would follow that natural love would be perverse. And that natural love would not be perfected, but destroyed by charity. you look around the 13th century at what others had to say at the time about charity, Aquinas is almost alone in teaching this. That man by nature loves God more than himself and before himself. That it's not charity that introduces this love into the world. It's inscribed in nature. In the fall, by pride, we reverse the ordering. But what charity comes in to do is not to introduce the proper love of God above all things, but rather, in a sense, to restore and elevate what is already found by nature. Otherwise, Aquinas says, if by nature we love ourselves more than God, then charity comes in and destroys nature. It has to undo natural love in order to create supernatural love. And Aquinas says, that can't be it. Therefore, there, and for a theological reason, he really holds to the reality of there being inscribed in nature, in every creature, a preference for God more than self. That's going to manifest itself in different ways according to the capacities of different creatures. But that every creature's love participates in this inclination to God first and foremost. So to sum up then the importance then of Aquinas' teaching here on the fourfold character of the bonum suum, ratione individui, ratione specie, ratione generis, ratione similitudinis analogiae, I write this on page 204. Not all of an individual's proper goods are individual goods. This is really de Koninck's point. That's why he writes his essay. Not all of an individual's proper goods are individual goods, nor can those that are not individual goods be treated as individual goods. In this case, it's the love, proper love of the common good. Certain proper goods belong formally to the individual as an individual, to be sure. But other proper goods belong formally to the individual as a member of a species, a member of a genus, and a possessor of participated being. Moreover, these kinds of proper goods, the family and the city, the order of the universe and God, are not particular to the individual, but are common, respectively, to other members of the individual species, to other members of its genus, and to all other creatures generally. Thus, these goods do not have individual perfection as their sole purpose or end, but seek rather the perfection of various orders of individuals. Accordingly, an individual achieves his perfection not merely in singular goods proper to one, but also in common goods proper to many, according to various relations formally binding individuals to each other. Just extend that as members of a species, as members of a genus, or as participants, or just being a creature. And one final point to make before we close and open up for questions. De Koninck recognizes that because of this ordering of the goods, especially according to these formalities, there's an intelligent ordering then of the creatures who seek these goods as their perfections. There's an intelligent ordering of perfection-seeking subjects. It's not just an intelligent ordering of objects. But because there's an intelligent ordering of objects, there's also an intelligent ordering of subjects. The hierarchical order of goods is reflected in a hierarchical ordering of appetite, which itself orders the subjects possessing those appetites. Animate creatures are greater the more they have the capacity to apprehend and desire higher goods. On page 211, just to summarize this point. We can be tempted to think, of course, that higher appetite is representative of higher being itself. And this is what the conic fears of the personalists are doing. That there's a way of defending human dignity by just pointing to the human creature and saying, look, he's got power of intellection, he's got the power of volition, he's amazing, you know. And that's it, and just kind of stop there. And because he's the only creature that we recognize in material creation to have these powers, therefore he's unique, special, noble, and therefore is, you know, worthy of defense, no totalitarian oppression, you know. And those are good arguments to be made. They're not false, but for Deconic, they're just incomplete. We can be tempted to think that that higher appetite is representative of higher being just in itself, as if the higher being were the principle of his higher appetite. In a way, the statement is true, but it conveys only half the reality. The power of the will and of the intellect in which the will is rooted is not self-reflective in this sense. Higher beings do not possess will because they are more perfect. Higher beings are more perfect because by their will they can approach directly their proper and common goods in all of their diffusive magnitude as goods of the being species or of its genus or of its quality as a sharing created being. Therefore, we can say that the will manifests not simply the perfection of its subject, but more importantly, the perfection of its object. It's kind of reversing kind of the personalist argument. Man isn't great because he has will. Actually, he has will because the good that perfects him is great. And requires that kind of spiritual power in order to grasp and love it. Continuing on 2.13, and we'll end with this. The presence of reason and will in the intelligent creature, therefore, manifests not simply the creature's intensive imaging of God. More importantly, the presence of reason and will in the intelligent creature denotes his orientation to extensive goods lying outside of him, goods to which the creature's powers of intellect and will orient him directly. Consequently, through reason and will, the intelligent creature can reflect within his knowing and loving the full scale of extensive goodness existing outside of him. Therefore, contrary to the personalist doctrine of the primacy of the person, the presence of intellect and will in angels and men denotes not simply that they are great, but more precisely that their goods are great. And for Aquinas, that's the marvel, you know, of the human creature, not just that he possesses intellect and will, but that in his intellect and will, he can, in a sense, become all things, which is to say, by comprehending and possessing the whole of being, the whole of created being. He can know it, and he can love it, and he can recognize it as made for him, you know, as an expression of God's own good providence for him, and as the means by which God draws the human creature to himself, so that by knowledge and by love, and comprehending the good of the whole, that's how it is that the human creature inclines first and foremost to God. And that completes the larger picture in which then the good of the family and the good of the city are situated. That the family and the city have their place within the ordering of the whole. And it's within the ordering of the whole then that the family and the city, you know, possess their identity and their dignity, and it's within the whole that the human creature loves them properly. Okay, why don't we end there and just open for questions. We'll have more to say about this tomorrow. Deconic here spends a lot of time on the family and the city. Tomorrow we'll look at the universe and God as proper goods of the human creature, just to perfect or just to complete this picture that Deconic draws, drawing on Aquinas' doctrine of the proper good. Just taking a full account or giving a full account of the fullness of man's proper good. Yeah.
One of the proper good of the human person, ratione generis. I think I wrote a quote. So Thomas says it's the good of a quote-unquote agents.
Right.
And I think De Koninck says both intelligent, he expands it for
right.
intellectual substance.
Right.
So is a human person only have this good as an intellectual creature, or is the human person also an equivocal agent, and if so, how?
Yeah.
I'm entirely sure.
Sure. So when I think De Koninck, so
that sentence that I said is about as clear as mud. I mean, when
De Koninck gets to that, I mean, he sees that it's true, and well, I'll explain why in a moment, but it doesn't really serve his argument. It doesn't. There's more to say about the good ratione generis than just equivocal agency. And because he understands what Aquinas, I think, is getting at here, he adds intellectual creatures there just to make it clear that equivocal agency, you know, for Aquinas is talking about there's two kinds of agency, univocal agency and equivocal agency, you know. And so univocal agency is like human generation, where man begets man, or any kind of generation, dog begets dog, tree begets tree, that the effect is the same formally as the cause. And that's univocal agency, univocal kind of causality. You know, equivocal is where the effect is formally different than the cause, so that the architect who builds the house, the fire that creates coal, the effect is similar and it has a relation to the cause, but formally completely different. And usually the way that works within creation is that univocal agency always works downward. The cause is always less than the effect in some way. I think what De Koninck wants to do here, he says, well, if the point here is that the effect is equivocal, that that it's different than, that kind of going beyond the limits of, at least in the sense lower, in equivocal agency, what you see in the intellectual creature is a kind of equivocal agency that also works upward. At least that, not in terms of causing or creating, but at least in being able to gather and receive. That by the agency of his intellect, the human creature can come to comprehend and love goods that lie beyond his mere species good. That he can actually comprehend and love the good of the universe, which is only accessible to him insofar as he's an intellectual creature. That's why it becomes proper to him then as a member of an intellectual genus. So I think that's what De Koninck sees here. That's kind of the adjustment that he makes to Aquinas, that at the genus level, intellect's ability to go beyond and above, what's proper to the nature of the intellectual creature, going above and beyond just his individual and species good, is a way in which the good of the whole becomes, the good of the universe becomes proper to the human creature at that level.
And is a greater good for
That's right. That's right. I mean, it becomes a greater good for him. Now the question is, okay, well, how is it, that the good of the universe is better than, let's say, the good of the city? I mean, we can talk about that. But maybe the better question is, how is it that how does he love the universe, engage the universe more than, let's say, the city? And obviously, man is limited by his nature there. I mean, he can know and comprehend the whole of the universe, but it doesn't become a kind of object of agency and loving in the same way as the city does. But as I said before, I think Aquinas does have this notion that, I mean, in contemplating, I mean, things greater than the city, which is to say the order of the universe, that we come to know and we learn things about reality, metaphysical truths, that should then inform how it is that we act in the family and in the city. So I think that's a way in which, proper to the rational animal who can comprehend the good of the whole, how he, in a sense, loves and reflects his love of the whole within that which he can, more immediately express and live. Yeah.
You had an interesting discussion from 2007 to 2008 on kind of defining the difference between clients, animals, and humans. And
right.
It'd be safe to say that insofar as intellectual creatures, namely humans, are able to comprehend the good of genus, like they're able to almost transcend above kind of just mere like evolutionary processes, insofar as like that becomes
mm-hmm.
like the evolutionary process is much more indirect and a particular good, but nevertheless sustaining the species good.
Right.
Insofar as we're able to kind of transcend above that, see higher orders, like it's in that function that we become kind of stewards,
mm-hmm.
you know, of the lower species.
Right.
Is that like a fair rendering, you think?
I think so. I mean, I think that we have the this not being my specialty. I would say this: there is a strong sense in Aquinas that natures are not themselves kind of subject to human judgment, which is in the sense that that we can, in a sense, determine what they are or the goodness and evil of them. That God is their author. God is the author, you know, of nature. So, you know, insofar as you do have adaptation of nature, the creation of new natures within evolution, that I think would have to be worked out. I think, though, there is a way within Thomas's framework to recognize something like evolutionary change and kind of become a steward of it. Recognizing that the evolutionary process itself can be, you know, the way that secondary causes work are themselves providential, you know. But it's always going to be within the view of the greater whole to see how it is, you know, that those evolutionary processes reflect, you know, the goodness of the whole. That if there's any cooperation with them, it would be, you know, to help them to in fact achieve their natural good and not manipulated for some other purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
This probably wades right into a big 20th century Thomistic debate, but
right.
Can you say a little bit more about if man's love of God is natural, how that fits with the end of man as the beatific vision
mm-hmm.
being a supernatural
right.
end, we have
right.
this natural love
sure.
for God. Natural orientation.
Right.
How is that
yeah.
on the same plane?
So I think an easy way, a quick way to distinguish, it may not satisfy all questions or answer all questions, but it's, I mean, God is the object of our natural loving. It's knowledge of him as first cause and final end. It doesn't imply vision, friendship, but it's knowing that he is what he is. And loving him insofar as we're able to know him naturally, I think suffices there. That, in grace, the Lord offers us vision of himself, union with him, friendship, is just a further, it's certainly a perfection and elevation, supernatural perfection and elevation of what he's already inscribed in nature, not that it's owed to nature, but something graciously given. So I think that it's an important thing to kind of keep those two things distinct. So that God is the object of our natural knowledge is his knowledge of him as first cause and final end. God is the object of faith. The knowledge of the object of faith is vision, you know, of him. First through the act of belief in faith, but then finally in the beatific vision in glory.
This is sort of a related question. With this third excerpt here, you said that he was pretty much alone amongst his peers and thinking that
right.
God's, human's natural love is towards a God.
Mm-hmm.
Who or what did they base that on? Who was the most influential, and how did his view affect theological debates going forward in the church?
Right. I'm off the top of my head, I can't pull kind of the whole history together, but someone who has, and a good book for this, is Tom Osborne's Love of God, Love of Self in the 13th Century. He kind of maps this out and helps you to see, both in kind of the predecessors to Aquinas and those who come after him, where Aquinas himself fits in with this teaching. So that'd be a good place to start. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm wondering what the practical difference is between the moral theory of de Koenig and the personalists he has in mind, whether it's Maritain or whoever. I mean, is it, you know, the primary moral categories are no longer, you know, personal autonomy.
Right.
But it's more the communal obligations. Is it a priority of solidarity over subsidiarity? What do you think about that?
I think what gets into Koenig's crawl, you know, what keeps him up at night, what makes him write here, is really it's an anthropological question, which has moral implications. So insofar as we put on the board, insofar as some personalist writers, and it's hard to, I mean, Maritain does this, but it's not clear to me that he's writing specifically against Maritain. As I said earlier, I think if de Koenig was going to go after the big boys, I mean, Mounier, Maritain, other, he would have written a very different work than this one. I think he's concerned with kind of second-tier writers, Catholic writers in their various disciplines, whether it be economics, history, law, politics, whatever, who in their own disciplines start employing this language of the primacy of the person. They don't themselves declare themselves to be personalists. They're not deep into kind of personalist theory, but this is kind of it's the catchy idea. It's the new idea of the day, and it seems to do a lot, especially if totalitarianism is the opponent. And de Koenig says, look, rallying around the person is the right thing to do here, but be careful when you talk about the primacy of the person. Let's understand what you're talking about, because there's some ways in which you can describe a primacy of the person that's in keeping with the greater Catholic tradition, but also there's a way in which it opposes and severely opposes the greater Catholic tradition, which through Thomism and other schools, I mean, has held for the primacy, not of the person, but of the common good. And why is that important? De Koenig sees that in some ways in promoting the primacy of the person, it, in a sense, kind of destroys the moral life. because if you promote the person so much that he, in fact, the human person himself becomes, in fact, the greatest thing in the world, then every other good and the love of every other good then becomes instrumental to you. You know, you have no choice but to love every, if you are the greatest thing in the world, you have no choice but to love every other thing, even all the things that promote your perfection, for yourself. All love becomes then self-redounding. Now, the thing is that I love the banana, the hamburger, my shirt, all those things for myself. Individual goods, that's the way we love. But that's not the way we love common goods. We can't love common goods that way. Yes, I do receive a benefit from them, but why do I love it? It's not for myself, but for itself. And it's self-effusing good, which is good not just for me, but for others. That the proper way to love the common good is to love it in its shareability, in its communicability, as common, which is to say, not just for me, but for us. So there's a sense then in which these goods, in terms of, you know, they do, family, city, universe, they are love for themselves, that I don't direct my love for them back to me, which I think is what Aquinas, de Koenig sees in as an implication of the kind of primacy of the person talk that he sees, you know, common in his day. I do think Maritain falls subject to this because he has this distinction between the individual and the person. So according to man's material individuality, yes, man is part of the family, the city, the universe. He's subject to all, you know, physical laws and all of the obligations that belonging to these things, you know, require. But as a spiritual person, well, he's only superseded by God himself. And he has a direct orientation to God. Therefore, in his highest self, everything material, family, city, universe, all become instrumental to him in his spiritual flourishing. And that's what de Koenig has a problem with. Because then that creates a situation where the human creature has to love all of those goods, even the common goods, for its individual, personal, spiritual flourishing. And he think that's, to kind of, that's disordered.
that creates tyrants. That's, I mean, he thinks that that fits Deconic, Aquinas's definition of the tyrant, the one who loves the common good not for itself but for himself. And so all every so you know, the family, the city, then just become little societies of tyrants. You know, all loving these goods instrumentally, you know, for their own flourishing and not seeing them as something bigger. Another thing here is that when you look at how it is that the bonum suum unfolds, the goods proper to me as an individual, as a member of a species, member of a genus, and as created being, what Deconic sees in that kind of doctrine of the primacy of the person is that the whole of the proper good is collapsed into simply one formality. Every good then becomes simply a good of the individual and is loved as such. And that's what he thinks is at the heart of Marxism, and that's why he makes all those connections. That's at the heart of Marxist anthropology, and that's why he makes those connections with the fallen angels and says, look, you can talk about the primacy of the person, writing again to his audience, these, I think, like I said, second-tier Catholic writers, but be careful, you know, just know what you're saying. You are at risk of kind of collapsing kind of this wide range of the proper good into one, and in fact, the lowest category. And promoting a kind of, you know, self-love and kind of self-worship. And the instrumentalization of high and noble goods simply to the good of the individual. So I mean that's kind of that's the moral problem, you know, that he has or is trying to work against.
So I think this feeds into what you've just been saying. How do you draw a little bit more about this category of desire? Because mm-hmm. I understand it, that being is good insofar as it attains its perfection, but it needs true desire. It should desire that it attains the perfection of being. It's not absurd to say that sin is a kind of desire as well. Right? You could desire, you know, the banana and you could desire food and family and those are good things. But you could also desire wealth, power, fame, honor.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things that would, you know, would lead to an imperfectibility of being. So how does this notion of being of desire, or rather desire for the sin of desire, fit into this system
right.
You've been doing?
Well, I mean, so in our fallen state, I mean, sparked by pride, in our fallen state, you could just talk about the whole of Thomas's anthropology. I mean, we'd be here till next week. But yeah, I mean, simply put, we make bad judgments about the goods that are for us in our prudential decisions, in the pursuit of goods, we make bad judgments about what's good for me here and now. And either prompted by pride or by passion, we choose goods for us that are either in themselves disordered or we love them in a disordered way to satisfy either our pride or our passion. And that's kind of the quick answer. But there is, I mean, Thomas, within his anthropology, within his moral theory, I mean, has an account for. The problem for Aquinas is not that desire is bad. I mean, love is what that makes the world go round for Aquinas. It is true. And it's rooted in imperfection seeking perfection. That's just the metaphysical foundation of everything, of every movement. But in rational creatures, through a defect of reasoning, we can make errors and bad judgments about that. In a similar way, there can be, you know, defects in nature too. But there can be defects in our moral reasoning that lead to sin.
So would it be safe to say that, I guess my question is, do you think the imperfections that orient our desires in this life will be the same? Or because, you know, there'd be different types of affections, be different types of desires, and therefore different kind of ordering of the good.
In heaven?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know if Aquinas would say that. Our nature will be perfected, you know, in every way. I mean, to see God, I mean, to be brought into communion, you know, with the Trinity is to have, you know, every imperfection, every potency perfected. We can speak of kind of increase of perfection, but there's never, that increase is never rooted in defect, you know.
Still not seeing yourself as a part to a whole, which is necessarily some kind of imperfection.
Oh, so, okay, so, well, not in that sense. So, I mean, it is true that, and to kind of, we'll see this more tomorrow, that that the part whole reality obtains even in heaven because of our membership in the heavenly city, which begins now in the church. That there's no, that beatification and beatitude for Deconic, and he's getting this, you know, from Aquinas, is whereas there is involved a particular kind of vision, like my vision of God is not your vision of God, so there is something particular about that, but that its full enjoyment is still as a social political being, which means that, you know, we enjoy that in the society of the saints, which means the real practical implication of that is that in looking at the face of God and beholding the divine good, the divine essence, I love it, again, not as something just for me, but as shareable. You know, I love it because it's the good of the, it's the universal good that extends itself universally. So Aquinas, Deconic makes that point, even if were there only one person in heaven, he's all alone, you know, it's just him and God. The proper love of beatitude is still loving God as a common good, as shareable, even if no one else is sharing it. Is again the moral implication. So so it's even social, yeah, at least, you know, in potency, if there were no, but the church guarantees us that there are other people in heaven. So so there is the heavenly city waiting for us. Yeah.
So is this a quick cryptic allusion to what equivocal agents desire? Is that saying that angelic governors of various celestial bodies, by doing their work, are contributing to the order of the universe? Is that
right?
Is that how they're designing their proper good?
Well, I mean, insofar as they're creatures created by God as parts of a whole, yeah, whatever equivocal agency they exercise is already kind of ordered by what it is that God has ordained. So
the angel of Mars, spinning Mars, is contributing to his proper good because it fits into the order of the whole.
Right? Yeah, well, I mean, okay. He's fulfilling what it is that he does, you know, if in fact this is what's happening.
I'm just trying to try to...
And for the good of the whole, like, that's right. So that even... that even the good that we do in terms of equivocal agency is kind of determined by our nature of whom God is the author, you know. We can't spin planets. That's not part of our, you know, good. But what we can do is till the soil, you know. And so that, in exercising that kind of equivocal agency is what is, in fact, is assigned to us by the nature, you know, we've been given. And to exercise that agency not only leads to our own happiness and fulfillment, but fits into the good of the whole. And why it's especially important for the intellectual creature, it's because he can see the order of the whole, he can understand the limited work that he does within the order of the whole and orient, rationally, reasonably orient his work, you know, according to the order of the whole. And this is how he glorifies God. The brutes do this by instinct, but we do it by intelligence and by love. Which is, you know, part of the greatness of human dignity. Question here?
Yeah. Just back to that question about the practical sort of ethical objections that he has against personalism.
Right.
I think part of it, and especially when that quote you referenced about it turning society into like a society of just frustrated tyrants,
mm-hmm.
I think that part of it is also, there's a question of the usurpation of proper powers.
Because mm-hmm.
there's a liberal theorist, John Dewey, kind of says that all what claims to rights and unqualified rights are essentially power claims against society.
Mm-hmm.
So that personalist conception where you have these unqualified, inimpeachable, unabridgeable rights is sort of like a tyranny over society for your private good to, you know, say whatever you want or sell whatever you want or distribute whatever you want at mm-hmm. the expense of this group that is sort of subject to human act.
Right. I mean, that opens up a huge, I mean, just kind of the nature of kind of rights claims, rights taught. I mean, you do have it in Aquinas. And I think it's important that as we kind of contend with kind of the rights regime that we have right now, I think Aquinas can be informative. Just again, what I said earlier, Aquinas just seems that claims are just naturally made. I mean, people make claims for what is their due. But in the exercise of justice and the unfolding of justice, not only in one's individual life, but socially, it's always a concern for the claim of the other, you know, not my own claim, necessarily. It's a fixed disposition of the will that to render the other his due. And so the just man is concerned that the other gets his due. That's his first movement, not me. You know. But it's within that same network of justice, that same realm of justice, that I defend myself if I'm attacked. You know, I need some food. You know, when I'm hungry, if I'm destitute, you know, the goods of the other, you know, become mine by nature, you know, because of my destitution. So I mean, so it's not absent in Aquinas, but the whole thrust of the concern of justice is for the good of the other, which. That's why Aquinas kind of establishes that triangle of justice that I put on the board the first day. Why is this legitimate? Why is this reasonable? Because we're fellow parts of the same whole. It's not just because they're a great individual or I'm respecting their individual dignity. No, actually, we belong to the same thing. And again, it's also not just because we share a similar nature, but because we share the same common goods. We are members of the same family, members of the same city, same polis, same political community, you know, or any other kinds of communities that we can make. We're parts of the same whole. Yeah. I think one more question.
I guess to what extent, if you brought this up a little bit earlier, but to what extent is this kind of affected by sin, by fallenness for Thomas? Because it seems like on the level of experience, it's not only, we don't seem to love God naturally, but we don't even really seem to love our friends. There's a kind of like Epicureanism, like under my breath, I make these sacrifices because it's in my best interest in the long run. So I guess, how does he deal with that?
I mean, I think there's a way to look at it. I mean, that sin weakens nature but doesn't obliterate it. That's a good Catholic position to hold, and actually our experience of self-love confirms that. I think for Aquinas, I mean, all of our loving is rooted in the love that we naturally have for ourselves, and that's kind of inescapable. And why for Aquinas is that the case? Well, because we enjoy a union with ourselves, or unity with ourselves, that's greater than the union we can enjoy, you know, with others. And so that's why he understands and defines friendship as, you know, extending to the other the love and the consideration that we have for the self. Jesus says the same, you know, kinds of things. And so in sin, I mean, what happens is the ability, you know, to extend to others, you know, the love that we have for ourselves, you know, becomes weakened, it becomes clouded. You know, the love that we have for ourselves becomes more pleasurable to us than the sharing of that love, you know, with others. You know, we orient the pursuit of even our particular goods, or especially of our particular goods, but also even of our common goods to the love that we have for self instead of for the love that we should have for others, that we extend to others in friendship. Loving the family for the sake of the other members of the family. Loving my city for the sake of my fellow citizens. But instead, we just instrumentalize those goods and love them for ourselves because of the natural love, the natural and good love that we have for ourselves, but it becomes disordered. That we still love ourselves in sin is a sign that nature is not obliterated. All right. Okay. Really, this really. All right. Then we'll have to stop for a moment.
What do you think are natural causes for those individuals who deny proper goods, member of the species, right? A generation and. You know, you hear peers saying, well, I don't want to get married.
Right.
And, you know, impedes my time, impedes my freedom, and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And do you think it's possible to reorient their intellect to grasp those goods at all, at a natural level, as opposed to our realization that we're falling and so forth?
I mean, I think it's just part of kind of moral intellectual formation. I mean, that we just, that there are goods higher than the goods that promote your own kind of self and self-sufficiency. I mean, just the way you put it, you know, they forego these other goods because they don't see the way in which they serve the self immediately, you know. But the point about species goods is that they don't serve the self immediately. But in fact, it's good for you as a part of the greater whole to serve the whole, you know. So to, and in fact, that's not opposed to your own particular good, but that the pursuit of your own particular good is taken up into that. So within the family, it's not that you abandon eating. It's not you abandon, you know, all the things that keep you in being. No, it's in the family that you enjoy those goods, but in a new and better way, sharing them, you know, with others, sharing them with fellow parts of a greater whole. So, there's some intellectual formation. You can explain this to them, but also, I mean, the experience of this should. And that, I think, is one of the consequences, of the breakdown of the family and things like this. Fewer and fewer people have the experience of healthy family life where they experience themselves that these are perfections of human individuals. How do you begin to rebuild that? Well, I mean, build one yourself. That's it. Okay, thank you all.